Our passage this evening is 2 Samuel chapter 9. And beginning to read at verse 1. Now David said, "Is there yet someone left to the house of Saul that I might show him faithful love for Jonathan's sake?" And there was a servant in the house of Saul, his name was Ziba, and they summoned him to David. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "Your servant." Then the king said, "Is there not someone still left in the house of Saul that I can show him the faithful love of God?" And Ziba said to the king, "There's still a son of Jonathan, lame in his feet." And the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Why, he's in the house of Machir, son of Amiel, in Lodabar." So David sent and got him from the house of Machir, son of Amiel, from Lodabar. And when Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came into David, he fell on his face and showed obeisance. And David said, "Mephibosheth." And he said, "Indeed, your servant." And David said to him, "Don't be afraid, for I will surely show you faithful love on account of Jonathan, your father. And I shall restore to you all the holdings of Saul, your father. But you are to eat bread at my table continually." And he showed obeisance and said, "What is your servant that you've turned to a dead dog like me?" Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's man, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I've given to the son of your master. And you shall tend the ground for him, you and your sons and your servants, and you shall bring in the produce, and it shall be for food for your master's son that he may eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's son, will eat bread continually at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. So Ziba said to the king, "In line with all my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." And Mephibosheth was eating at his table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son. His name was Micah. And all who lived in Ziba's household were servants to Mephibosheth. But Mephibosheth was staying in Jerusalem, for he was continually eating at the king's table. And he was lame in both his feet. "Is there yet someone left of the house of Saul that I might show him faithful love for Jonathan's sake?" That's kind of the vogue among some scholars, not all, but some, that anything you hear a biblical character say or do, etc., that might be positive, you automatically suspect it. You suspect their motives, you don't take anything at face value, you never take it in the obvious sense, it's never as it seems. If you can find a bush, there's a suspicion behind it. Now, that's the way some scholars tend to operate in these narratives. The idea here is, well, yes, it seemed to be nice and faithful for David to bring Mephibosheth to Jerusalem to always be eating at his table, but he knew Mephibosheth was the grandson of King Saul, the former king, and if he had Mephibosheth in Jerusalem, he could keep him under his thumb, he could keep his eye on him so that he couldn't foment rebellion. That's really why David wanted Mephibosheth there. There was an undercover reason, etc. But sometimes it's simply the simple that's true. That's sort of like that affair in Charlie Brown, the Peanuts cartoon we've mentioned before. Charlie Brown's looking at a picture that Linus has drawn, and he says, "This is a very nice picture of a man that you've drawn, Linus. I notice that you picture him with his hands behind his back." And then donning, as it were, his white coat, Charlie Brown says, "You did that because you yourself have feelings of insecurity." And Linus said, "I myself did that because I myself can't draw hands." Now, sometimes it's just simple. And that's the way I think it is here. If the suspicious keep tabs on Mephibosheth, interpretation were correct, why did David restore all of Saul's estates and holdings to him? Why lavish that upon him? It doesn't really jive with that interpretation. And so here's David. "Is there yet someone left to the house of Saul that I might show him faithful love, hesed, for Jonathan's sake?" Actually, there's a covenant behind those words. And 2 Samuel 9 teaches us that life under covenant gives you a place of security, privilege, and wonder. Now, what does the writer want to underscore and wants you to focus on in this passage? Well, first, I think he wants you to see the power covenant exercises, verses 1 to 3, the power covenant exercises. Now, we've already mentioned verse 1, and that David wanted to show faithful love for Jonathan's sake to someone of his descendants. And so this leads to an interview with Ziba, who was apparently the head servant and overseer of Saul's estate and so on. And of course, by this time, Jonathan has been dead some time. He died back at the Battle of Gilboa in 1 Samuel 31 and so on. You may wonder, why do we drag the idea of covenant in here? Well, it's because this word used here, faithful love, it's the Hebrew word hesed, H-E-S-E-D, and we don't pronounce it with the hard H like it's supposed to be because it keeps moisture from going out in the front pews. So we just say hesed. And it's a difficult, some translate it kindness, sometimes faithful love, devoted love. It's love that sticks and stays. It's love that commits itself and refuses to let go. That's hesed. And David promised that to Jonathan's seed in a covenant. You have to go back to 1 Samuel chapter 20, verses 14 to 16. I know it's a difficult text. I know it's hard to translate, etc. And there are some rough parts in it. But it was in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 14 and following, that Jonathan asked David to make a promise in a covenant. And these are Jonathan's words. 1 Samuel 20, 14 and following. And will you not, if I'm still alive, he's looking at a time when he knows David's going to be king. He's sure of that. And so he's saying, if I'm still alive when you become king, will you not treat me with the hesed of Yahweh that I not die? And you must not cut off your hesed from my house forever, not even when Yahweh cuts off each one of David's enemies from the face of the ground. So Jonathan cut a covenant with the house of David. It's that commitment that David is here preparing to fulfill. Is there anyone left in the house of Saul that I might show him hesed for Jonathan's sake? Because I made that covenant to Jonathan. Now, it's been 15 or 20 years perhaps. We don't need to go into the chronological reasoning for this and so on. But by 2 Samuel 9, it may have been 15 or 20 years since the time in 1 Samuel 20 that David made that covenant commitment to Jonathan. It's been some time. But that promise is still controlling and directing his behavior here in verses 1 and 3. It was a solemn word given in a solemn ceremony under a solemn curse. He would take a curse upon himself if he didn't fulfill his promise. It was that covenant that constrained him to act with hesed, faithful love, toward Mephibosheth in this case. It's a love that refuses to forget. There was nothing here about, oh, that was a long time ago when we made that covenant, or, well, conditions and circumstances have changed, or, it was just a ceremony. No, there was none of that. Now, we sometimes do that in human situations, don't we? Franklin Roosevelt was in Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania, not Kansas. I know you were worried about that. In 1932, and he was making a speech pleading for government fiscal responsibility, so on. And then he was running for re-election in 1936, and he was to make a speech in Pittsburgh. And he wanted to argue for government spending. He didn't want to appear too inconsistent. So he asked his assistant, Sam Rosenman, if he could figure out a way how he could maneuver around this so that he wouldn't look like he was inconsistent and a hypocrite and talking out two sides of his mouth and so on, how he could make this switch. And after a few days, Sam Rosenman said to FDR, I think I found a way out of your dilemma, Mr. President. And he said, oh, what is it, Sam? He said, deny that you made a speech in Pittsburgh in 1932. Well, sometimes the way it is, we want a sachet out of commitments later and so on. But there was none of that with David. You see, there's a certain power sometimes in a covenant that's taken the way it ought to be. It's this promise that was made in the covenant in the past that directs fidelity in the present and controls behavior for us. Now, we can't go into this in further detail, but if you're a Christian, your life is made up of covenant obligations in a way. You make a covenant when you make a public profession of your faith before the congregation. You make vows. You take vows if, as parents, you have some of your children baptized here. You engage in really covenant vows. First Sunday night of every year, we renew a covenant here at First Press. And when you get married, you enter into a covenant. You make covenant promises, and those are the control, or ought to be the control, that drive your living and your commitments and your obedience. I remember several years back, well, this last fall, one of my sister-in-laws died, and she was the wife of my second brother. They had a marriage of over 60 years together, and they immensely enjoyed each other and their family. About maybe 10 years ago or so, she began slipping a little bit mentally, and then this became more severe and strange behavior. My brother would have to secure the mail, or it'd end, she'd have it ripped up somewhere. She might put food in a bathroom closet or somewhere. He had to watch that. It came to the point where her bodily necessities would not be taken care of in the bathroom, but just wherever she wanted, and he had to watch that and clean up after her and help clean her up and so on. It began to get, finally, after several years of this, he became so fatigued and overcome that he felt he had to get some help. And so there was a facility 2 miles from there where he was able to place her. But everybody in that facility knew Glenn, because he was the husband who came every day to visit his wife and to sit with her, even if she didn't speak to him, and so on. But in the middle of this, and when I think she was still at home and he was having such a time managing, he said to one of my other brothers who inquired of him, he said, well, I signed up for this. What did he mean by that? He meant that on August 19th, 1951, he had committed himself in a covenant. And that now it was maybe more sorrow than joy, maybe more sickness than health, but I sign up for this. It was a commitment he made, and it directed his life. There's a power covenant exercises, or ought to exercise. Now, secondly, you see here the provision covenant makes, verses 4 to 7, the provision covenant makes. Now, if I were able to do it, and so on, the screens that I ordered didn't come in, and so we can't sketch out the structure of 2 Samuel 9 and show you in living color that verse 7 is the very structural center of the passage. You have to take my word for it, that's all. But it is. It's the hinge of the whole passage. And you notice David's words there in verse 7. where he says, "Don't be afraid, for I will surely show you faithful love on account of Jonathan, your father," and so on and so forth. What is David doing there? What's the provision covenant makes? Well, notice for one thing, protection. Don't be afraid, for I will surely show you faithful love on account of Jonathan, your father. Protection. And then there's provision, isn't there? "And I shall restore to you all the holdings of Saul, your father." And then there is position, isn't there? "But you are to eat bread at my table continually." All of that is the provision covenant makes in the case of Mephibosheth. David just didn't spare Mephibosheth's life. He heaped goodness on him. Notice what stress there is on Mephibosheth eating at David's table. Four times in the passage, in the whole passage, verses 7, 10, 11, and 13. He's eating at David's table. Verse 11 says, "as one of the king's sons." What privilege he was given. So what do you see here is, in verse 7 especially, he's cared for by and with the king, and he will never face destitution. Now, in one sense, isn't that your position under God's covenant if you're a Christian? Isn't this David Mephibosheth's scheme a sort of a model of what God has provided for you, not on account of Jonathan, but on account of Jesus? What is that? Well, there's a chapter in the Westminster Confession of Faith you ought to get to know really well if you haven't. Chapter 12, it's the one on adoption. It's the privileges that you have because you're a child of God and God is your Father, and wonderful way in which it talks about the Lord's people. And it says they are pitied, protected, provided for, and chastened by him as by a father, yet never cast off. That's the provision made for you. Pitied, protected, provided for, and chastened as by a father, yet never cast off. That's the provision of the covenant. And are you not more surely provided for than even Mephibosheth? There's a text that I call the Psalm 23:1, since we sang Psalm 23 tonight. I call it the Psalm 23:1 of the New Testament. You know Psalm 23:1. "Yahweh is my shepherd, I will never lack anything." Well, the Psalm 23:1 of the New Testament is Romans 8:32. "He who did not hold back his very own son, but handed him over for us all, how can he fail with him to lavish every other gift upon us?" Is that not the provision he makes? Or Jesus' own words in his John 6:35 passage when he said, "I'm the bread of life." And then he said, didn't he, "the one who comes to me will never hunger, and the one who believes on me will never, ever thirst." George Hutchison, an old commentator, says of those words that they mean, "they who embrace him shall find all sufficiency in him for all wants, and that eternally." That's the provision covenant makes. That's why you can say that if you have Christ, you have all of that provision. That's why I like that story of the English gentleman who took a visitor out inside his home and was beginning to show him his estate. And he said, do you see that farm over there? He said, "Yes." "Well, that's mine." And he said, "Do you see that house out there?" "Yes." "Yeah." "Well, that also belongs to me." Well, the fellow was getting a little bit tired of it. And so he said to this to his host, "Do you see that village down there? There's a poor woman in that village who can say more than all of this." He said, "I? What can she say?" "She can say," he said, "Christ is mine." It's the provision covenant makes, and in him all provision I ever really need. Now then, thirdly, notice that the text underscores the person covenant embraces. The person covenant embraces. You look at the last of verse 11 through verse 13, especially here. "Mephibosheth was eating at his table like one of the king's sons, and Mephibosheth had a young son. His name was Micah, and all who lived in Ziba's household were servants to Mephibosheth. But Mephibosheth was staying in Jerusalem, for he was continually eating at the king's table, and he was lame in both his feet." This last section, last 2.5 verses of our chapter, the writer himself sums things up, and he focuses on Mephibosheth. Most of the chapter takes place in conversation back and forth. But here, the writer himself closes it off, and in these last 2.5 verses, he mentions Mephibosheth by name 4 times out of the 7 times he's mentioned in the chapter. Now, there are 2 problems with Mephibosheth. First, his lameness. His lameness. You can't keep yourself from pitying Mephibosheth when you read that scrubby little note back in chapter 4, verse 4, that tells you that Jonathan had a son whose name was Mephibosheth, and he was 5 years old. And it was right after the battle of Mount Gilboa, and Jonathan had been killed in it. And news came to wherever the families were gathered about the Philistine victory. And apparently in panic of Philistine retribution, they got up to run and to flee. And I don't know whether his nurse, his nanny, picked Mephibosheth up to carry him and run, or whether she grabbed him by the hand and they started to run, but he fell. And who knows what it was. Did he break both his ankles? I don't know. But there were no orthopedics. And he was lame in both his feet. And on that dark, dreary day, he lost his father by death in battle. And he lost his mobility by a panicked accident. And here he was, a prince's son, but a helpless, dependent cripple. And it was his lameness. You notice in last of verse 3, when Ziba says, "Well, Jonathan has a son, he's lame in his feet." He didn't even mention his name. He just said he was lame in his feet. And Mephibosheth, when he spoke in verse 8, called himself a dead dog. "Why should you bother with a dead dog like me, David?" he said. Oh, his lameness. But there's something far worse about Mephibosheth than his lameness. It's his heredity. Did you notice it in verse 6? "Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David." He is, in a word, the enemy. I don't necessarily mean that David regarded him with personal hostility, but he is constitutionally the enemy. He's the descendant of the previous regime, the previous dynasty, Saul and Jonathan, now Mephibosheth. And he just was the wrong stuff. There's a certain miracle at the very heart of this covenant that David swore to Jonathan back in 1 Samuel 20. It's something that any self-respecting politician would not want to make. When a new dynasty came to power, the name of the game was purge. Mephibosheth knew that. Why is that their implication that he was afraid, verse 6, and implied in verse 7? That's because Mephibosheth's lameness was in his feet, not in his brain. He knew what happened to the descendants of previous regimes when a new dynasty came on the scene.
You liquefy in order to solidify. You wipe out the previous regime and the descendants in order to stabilize your own kingdom. You don't have to dig through archives of the ancient Near East. Go to your Bible. Go to 1 Kings 15 and you'll see that Baasha wiped out the house of Jeroboam. In 1 Kings 16, you find out that Zimri wiped out the house of Baasha when he became king. In 2 Kings 9 and 10, you find out that Jehu wiped out Ahab's household and all his supporters and loyalists in a bloody purge. You just did that with a previous regime. Mephibosheth knew that kind of stuff. And so everybody knew this policy. Everybody believed it. Everybody practiced it. Well, almost. David didn't. Why not? Well, because Jonathan had asked David to make an absurd promise that no sane politician, I suppose, in his right mind would be willing to make. David had promised that he would preserve and show chesed to Jonathan and his descendants. David had embraced the enemy within the safety of a covenant. Now, I don't have time to press this anymore, but perhaps you can see that we're kind of sliding into deeper waters here when you talk about an enemy being embraced within the safety of a covenant. We're maybe beginning to see a parallel between David's devoted love for his enemy, Mephibosheth. And the sort of thing that wasn't supposed to happen. And what you read of in Romans 5:10, for example, while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son. In fact, Paul's whole purpose in Romans 5, verses 6 through 11, is to drive home how simply unexplainable God's way with us is. You remember how that reads? Romans 5, verse 6. While we were yet helpless, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. Verse 8. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Verse 10, while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son. The first principle with grappling with the real theological problem, which is the marvel of God's love, the first principle for grappling with that problem is to realize that he really has no business loving whom he loves. What I'm saying to you is that, as Luther said, we are all the Lord's Mephibosheths. And there is absolutely no reason why you should continually be eating at the king's table. And if you have any sense, you won't be able to figure it out either. Our Father, so often we come to your word and we have to simply say, there is no God like you. No God like you who shows chesed for Jesus' sake. And so once more we come in gratitude, thanking you in his name. Amen.